Who's going to win the tournament for England in one name?
The Fantasy Football Show.
Hello, patrons. Hope you're well. Welcome to a very special Planet FPL patron podcast. We're going to be looking ahead to the Women's Euros that start on Wednesday and being hosted in England and kick off with the host nation hosting Austria in front of a capacity crowd at Old Trafford live on the BBC on Wednesday night. And I'm delighted to say I've got a great guest with us today, one of our own, Lauren Harris. How are you, Lauren?
I'm very good, thank you. Thanks Tell for having
us,
me on.
No, you're very welcome, mate. Tell us to start with, for those who don't know, who you are.
So I'm Lauren. You probably know me as a Liverpool fan.
You ain't the only one, mate.
Yeah, writing in the patron. I'm a very big Liverpool fan, but obviously you'll hear from my accent that I'm not a Scouser. So you might call me a glory hunter, but I'd like to think that when I started supporting Liverpool, it wasn't a necessary glory hunting years. I made the mistake of falling in love with Michael Owen when I was a child. obviously don't have that same affection now, but yeah, so when I was sort of 6, 7, Michael Owen was just breaking into the Liverpool team, and he had a TV show, and he sort of was what drew me to Liverpool. And I've played football for most of my life. Started when I was sort of 5, 6 years old. Charlton Athletic in the community came into my school and did training sessions, and then played with the boys till I was about 10. And at that time, the FA said you couldn't play football with boys once you reached the age of 10. So then I had to go and try and find a team. And in those days, there were very few girls' teams. So the closest club to me was actually a women's team. As ludicrous as it sounds, I was basically training with women aged like 18 all the way up to their 40s. This little 10-year-old running around with them, but that was the only option. And then my dad got me into a local team where he basically said to them that he'd run the team with his friend. So then we had a proper girls team, and you know, we could play properly. And then I got into the Kent County team, and while I was playing for Kent, scouted for Gillingham. So I played in the Gillingham Centre of Excellence, went to university, sort of took university more seriously in terms of drinking and having fun rather than playing football. I went to university in West London, so I did play for QPR for a bit when I was there. And then that's pretty much it in terms of playing football, because life sort of took over. And for me, it obviously didn't become a career. And now I just love watching it. And that's me, basically.
God, that's a nice story. There were so many times where they asked you questions that could probably fill a whole podcast. One, I'm sure that the guys are dying to know, your love for Michael Owen died because he ended up going to Old Trafford, or because you now have to listen to him on BT Sport?
Both. No, definitely started with Old Trafford, but yeah, he is boring, isn't he?
I take it that's why Liverpool was him, essentially.
Yeah. It was him, and then obviously it was Gerrard, but it was initially Owen. My youngest memory is Owen scoring against Arsenal in the 2001 season cup final.
It's one of the loudest non-Tottenham goals I've ever celebrated.
Yeah, so that was, I mean, my dad's a Leeds fan, and there's a picture of me in the, you know, do you remember the yellow Strongbow kit that they used to have?
Yes.
So he bought me that, I think, for a birthday. And then I basically said, but I love Michael Owen, I don't want to support it. And obviously then, Leeds were doing well.
They were decent, yeah, very much so.
And I think my dad was just happy that I didn't choose Man United. So he was like, well, didn't buy it.
Fair enough. And of course, the Liverpool ladies team has just been promoted to the Super League.
Yeah.
Does that change the fandom experience for you? Do you think it will? Going into next
definitely
year,
like,
what's your interest in the Liverpool ladies team?
Well, they were they were big when the Super League first started. Obviously, one when Casey Stoney played for them. And in my opinion, the men or the club as a whole hasn't invested in the women's side as well as they should have. And I guess the model that FSG run, that's not surprising. You know, there isn't the investment like Chelsea and Man City have got. But we know the difference in finances within the club. But the fact that they're now back in the Super League, it would definitely spike my interest in maybe following a team. I've always struggled in women's football to have a team that I follow because when I was a kid, you didn't hear about women's football. You didn't, you know, it's only been over the last few years that actually it's had that exposure. And you had to kind of outwardly seek the information rather than, you know, having all of that information. Whereas now we can watch them on Sky. You've got Twitter, which obviously is a wealth of knowledge and information that you can get to find out various things. So I think it will definitely help me as a women's football fan to have maybe feel a bit more connected with it. There's so many, I don't know if you see any on Twitter, but there's loads of like sort of women's fan groups and they're very passionate about the team that they follow and the team they support. And they are supporters of the men's team as well as the women's team. But, you know, particularly thinking of like Chelsea, City and Man United and Arsenal, because the women's teams have been so strong in recent years, and obviously Man United only recently came into existence, but because there's been that investment and the club is so supportive of the women's team, I think it's been easy for those sorts of fans to feel that connection with their women's team. Whereas I think for Liverpool, it's kind of been a bit more disjointed. And I think in recent years, they've tried to bridge that gap. But them being promoted to the Super League is definitely going to help that.
I mean, United feels like it's happened kind of suddenly overnight and then a couple of years to potentially be challenging for the top honours in that division. It feels like there's been quite a bit of a push in the Northwest. If I think back further, it always felt like it was Arsenal, in fairness, with a dominant known name, if you like, in women's football. Now you've got City, the investment in United, yourselves being promoted. Obviously, Everton are in the Super League as well. And going back to the 2005 Euros, that were in England, a lot of the planning strategy actually was to host a lot of the games in the Northwest because the Northwest clubs were not as receptive to it and it wasn't as accessible as perhaps it was. I'm not saying it was overly, but even less than perhaps it was saying that the South and the London areas. A question for you, and I think I know the answer. If the girls and the boys are playing at the same time next year, who are you watching?
Liverpool.
Yeah.
That's a tough question. Well, it depends on who I can watch. So you're saying if they're both on telly?
Both on telly, same time, yeah.
Same I'd have opponent. To say the men, and that is a terrible answer from me. But the connection I have with the men's team is far stronger than I have with the women's team, and that's not to say that I don't think that connection could grow and I won't have an invested interest in it. But my whole life of football has been following Liverpool Men's Football Club. And I guess the answer I should have said would be the women's. But, you know, that is honestly, it would be the men at this moment in time.
You gave the honest answer that I thought you'd give. Yeah. I actually thought you'd find that answer easier because of what you'd already said about the connection with you and your own club. Is this part of the battle, though, is to change that? Or do you want it changed?
Yeah, I mean, it's massively ingrained, isn't it, in anyone who is my age and maybe 4 or 5 years younger, who is a woman who is interested in football, will be in the same situation. You've grown up following a men's team and that's you've had role models and idols who, to be honest, have been men, and they are the players who have got you into the sport. And I think it will change. There will be a culture change in young girls. You've got so much more exposure now. So Leah Williamson, Lucy Bronze, particularly those two are sort of the faces of women's football in England at the moment. And when I was younger, the only sort of exposure I had to a women's footballer was like my mum and dad took me to the Den to watch Arsenal in the FA Cup.
Oh, you poor girl.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, now I go there every week. That's a different different situation. So that was the only time I sort of saw a women's footballer, because you didn't see them on TV. You didn't, you know, there wasn't, when I was young, there wasn't social media, obviously. So it's, you know, it's completely changed. And I think the more young girls are exposed to women's football naturally alongside the men, that will change and the fandom will grow. But yeah, for me, it's always been the men. And so it's hard to sort of break away from that.
This is part of the challenge, isn't it? Is changing that psyche in terms of the growth, because like me and Suj have spoken about the idea of perhaps watching Tottenham against West Ham, but it's got to fall into place in terms of not clashing with the men.
Not clash.
Weather, to be honest, we discussed it was I think it was 6:45 kickoff on a Sunday in January. Like, we both live down the road from Barnet, where Tottenham have their home games. Do we want to? And that's a challenge, isn't it? And that particular fixture was on TV as well. What was the reason to go and watch? Do you feel, obviously, the push of Sky and BBC hosting the Women's Super League now, I get a sense that there's a little feeling that it's almost a hindrance. In terms of exposure, it's no doubt helping the game. I think BBC have had sort of like 2-3 million viewers for some of their bigger games, which is generally more than what Sky will get for a Premier League game, for example. But do you feel it's harming the game in a certain way in terms of certain people decide not to go?
Yeah, I think like that Sunday evening match is good for getting a TV audience, because if someone has watched the Super Sunday matches and, you know, they haven't got a family or they haven't got, you know, things to be doing on a Sunday evening, they might just keep it on and watch it. But like you said, that you're not gonna leave your house on a Sunday afternoon, go to a game. I mean, if you don't live, for example, your example of Spurs West Ham, for me to get there, that would take, I don't know, two and a half hours, depending on traffic. And then if that game's not finishing until 8-9 o'clock on a Sunday evening and you've got to travel back, it's not I mean, there's a reason that there isn't a Premier League game at that time, isn't there? You know, that for the fans, you wouldn't have.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have a Premier League game. Yeah. For fans to travel back,
with the men's, obviously, you've got away fans will always moan, no matter where. Basically, unless it's 3 o'clock on a Saturday, away fans will always moan about the kickoff time, basically. But there is that to factor in as well.
Yeah. And I think there is. They've started to have a early kickoff women's game on a Sunday before the Premier League starts, which again is good for the TV, because that's sort of dead time, really, if you're, you know, when you're just waiting for the 2 o'clock Premier League game. If there isn't an earlier Premier League game, it's good for TV viewing. But again, is that too early? If people have got to travel 2-3 hours, whatever it is, you know, the Super League hasn't got a huge number of teams. So unless you live in London or you live in one of the cities where there is a team, you're going to have to travel quite a long time to watch.
I was just thinking more about that Tottenham West Ham game. If I'm right, it didn't happen, because it was also meant to be the Sunday of the North London Derby, which was going to be a 4:30 kickoff before Arsenal faked their COVID test. Jokes, guys, get over it. So I wouldn't have been able to go anyway.
Yeah.
So Tottenham Arsenal would have been finishing at what, 25 past six. The girls are kicking off in Barnet. 20 minutes later, I wouldn't even be on a train within 20 minutes, never mind trying to get there. And that's also a problem, isn't it? With men's and women's scheduling potentially clashing as well.
Yeah, I think if you want to grow the spectators within the ground to, you know, tens of thousands, it's got to be in working with the men's teams. But I think that's a small part of the issue. And I think we had this chat before we started recording about the target audience. I don't think that the target audience at the moment is, as you say, for people going to grounds, the target audience is what is best for the TV viewer. And I don't know if that's maybe at the moment a hangover from COVID, because there was obviously people didn't go to the stadiums and there was a lot of focus on TV viewing during the pandemic. And it doesn't seem like women's football has sort of moved past that yet. We're not targeting people who like women's football, aren't, you know, don't have any barriers against wanting to watch women's football. It feels like the sport isn't geared towards that audience at the moment. And as I said to you, that there are over 2.5 million women in this country who play football. And if you play football, not everyone, but a lot of people that play football probably like watching football. And they all play on a Sunday afternoon. 90% more than that, women's Super League matches are on a Sunday afternoon. So any woman who plays football can't go to a women's Super League game unless it's the Saturday match. So if you think about how many people that's sort of, you know, they can't get to a game full stop, who, you know, I would travel to West Ham, Arsenal, Chelsea, you know, any of the London clubs, I'd happily travel and go and watch a Women's Super League game. And I probably will next season, to be honest, on my own. But my other half, who plays football, she can't come and watch as well because she's playing. But she'd love to, you know, she'd love to go and watch the Super League matches, but she just can't because of how it's scheduled. So there needs to be something done about that. But then you made a good point about, you know, if you've got West Ham women playing at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon and West Ham men are playing at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, you're not going to get the men's fans are going to go to the men's game if they're at home. So then, you know, I guess scheduling's quite hard, isn't it? But if you can work with the men's teams to figure, okay, so West Ham are away in Newcastle, you know, okay, the die-hard fans are going to travel up to Newcastle, they're going to go to the game. But there's going to be lots of fans who would normally go to London Stadium that aren't going because they're away. Can you schedule a West Ham women's game on that Saturday afternoon when West Ham are away to Newcastle? But then you've also got the issue of Arsenal play at Boreham Wood. Are Boreham Wood men at home when Arsenal men are away? And so there is...
Same with Spurs and Barnet and yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And London Bees play at the same ground as well, I believe.
I think you might be right there, yeah.
Yeah, so that's not just a men's and a women's team. That's two women's teams and a men's team you're all trying to schedule. So it's not easy. And, you know, there's no sort of quick answer. But I think the FA needs to work with the men's leagues and the women's leagues together to try and find a solution. Because there's just so many people that are being outcasted from being able to go to a game that, you know, would massively increase the spectatorship, in my opinion.
Am I right in saying when the Women's Super League was reformed, did it not become a summer sport?
Yes, originally it was. And then I think, I don't know why they changed it, but yeah, it was originally March. And then it fell in line with the men's. I don't know if that's to do with temperature or I'm not sure. I can't remember now why.
I guess back to winter. Probably an impact of things like Women's Euros being in July, for example. I don't know if that would affect things, but I feel like when it happened, it felt like, oh, well, if you're trying to increase match day attendances and exposure, having it on in the summer, I mean, what kind of exposure could it have potentially done to have women's football and the Women's Super League on for the last month when there's not been
nothing
a lot?
Else I mean,
like, the other week was like, oh, great, watching the under-19s. I haven't watched any football for 2 weeks. So, I mean, I just wonder why maybe that changed. There must be a reason why it didn't work or it got enforced to change.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. With the Super League teams sharing grounds with men's teams now, there's a lot of renovation works done over summer, isn't there, in terms of pitches. I know that the local football clubs near me, you know, some of them are digging up turf and, you know, doing various things. So I don't know if that has an impact. If it's a 3G pitch, so it doesn't matter, does it? You know, like, is London Bees 3G?
Barnet. is not, as far as I'm aware. I don't think so.
I'd imagine that. But obviously, if it is an artificial turf, then it doesn't matter. But the fact that the Euros are happening now, when there is no Premier League football, and the final will be obviously the weekend of the start of the Championship. So the majority of the tournament is going to have sole sort of exposure, other than the pre-season matches. But they're not,
No, there's no clash. I mean, the women's final is at 8 o'clock on the Sunday as well, so it's not going to clash with
anything. No, there won't be a championship match.
To the extent, Lauren, actually, we was going to do two Correspondent Week podcasts on the Monday and three on the Sunday, and I had a look and went, oh, scrap that, if England's in the final. So I'd put in the last one out at the same time as the women's final. So we're going to finish that at 4 o'clock on the Sunday instead, so everyone's free for the women's final on the Sunday night. But of course, yeah, everything's beforehand. So the country's got exposure now. What are your hopes, not from a football perspective, but more from an off field? What are your hopes from the tournament, and why is it important that it's being held here this summer?
Well, the 2019 World Cup was pretty huge in England, even though it was in France, because it was close. I think, it was easier for people to sort of make the trip. And I know a lot of people who went. And the impact of a young girl or any age really, but seeing that sort of scaled event, seeing a women's sporting event having such a big magnitude in terms of like media, being mentioned in the news, it's going to inspire a lot of young girls. I'm a PE teacher, and I teach secondary age students. And a lot of the girls at my school don't really care about sport. But the one thing that they do is when, like, key stage four, year 10s and 11s, they are terrible. And, that's fine. But they are constantly, we give them the option. We say, we can go and play rounders, we can go and play netball. And they're always asking to play football. They're not very good. They don't play for a club outside. But they've started to comment on the Women's Super League, and those little things can inspire people to just get involved. How many people, Wimbledon's on at the moment, how many people don't care about tennis all year round, and then Wimbledon's on, go and play a game of tennis, when, rest of the year you couldn't care less. And it has that kind of impact of, and you said don't give a footballing view, but if the women's team can progress, I think the impact it will have will be bigger, depending on how the national team does. If they get through to the quarters and the semis, I think normal people, and when I say normal people, people who maybe don't normally care about football, like we see with the men, may then start to have an interest. I'm not a tennis fan, but this is just an example. Going back to tennis, Emma Raducanu is a good example of, before she got to the quarters and the semis of the US Open, I know for a fact I wasn't following the US Open. I probably didn't even know it was happening. But then news broke out that this young British tennis star was sort of emerging. And then you started to watch the games and you started to get really invested in it. And do I watch more tennis now? Probably not. But it still had an impact on me that actually now I look at Raducanu's results at Wimbledon.
That's what I was going to say. You probably, because of that, now got a little bit of investment in her going forward.
Exactly. Yeah. And it will be the same with the women's national team. And what's really good is that next summer is the World Cup.
So it's in Australia and New Zealand, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's going to be, you've got this summer. And then hopefully if England do well and there's, a big buzz around the country and everyone sort of gets on board, maybe the Women's Super League viewing figures will be up and people will be more into women's football. And the fact that the World Cup is so soon after, particularly if England do well, maybe not win it, but, get to the semi or the final. And then next year, with the World Cup, it's going to, people will have more of an invested interest in it, which can only be a positive thing. And it's kind of...
Go on, sorry.
I was just gonna say it's like breaking down those little barriers, little things like just going back to where I work. There's many in my department who have historically maybe degraded women's football or made the odd joke, and that those sorts of things are starting to now be less socially acceptable. And the more that your everyday person is talking about women's football in a positive light, it will become more and more socially unacceptable, which is, I'm not going to compare it to homophobia or racism, but the more something is socially unacceptable, the less frequently it's going to happen, and the more positive people will be about that, whatever particular subject it is.
Here. I feel like the 2015 World Cup was a bit of a start. I remember being on holiday. Did we lose to Japan in the semi-final? I want to say. I forget the poor girl who scored the own goal that went in off the bar. I can still remember it.
Laura Bassett, yeah.
And me and the wife were on holiday, and it was like that. It was like exactly what you said with the kind of Emma Raducanu story, where it was, these girls have got a chance. It's the draw's opened up. We've got an opportunity. Going to avoid USA to the final. It's on, potentially. And even though I was out of this country, I felt like looking at news back home, I could feel it. Not to the extent of, obviously, the men's team and stuff, but you could feel like, for the first time, it felt like there was an investment in the women's team really coming on. Then we had high hopes for the last Euros in the Netherlands, and it was the semi-finals we got well beat, didn't we? I think, if I remember correctly.
But the Netherlands were very, very good that year.
They weren't so clever when they played us the other week, though, were they?
No, well, we've got their manager now, so... we've stolen her. And then the 2019 World Cup. I think the 2019 World Cup was more of a... I think the women's game as a whole in that World Cup, the quality of the football...
Agreed.
Was better. So it's the better the women's game gets, obviously the more people are going to respect it. And I think people sometimes forget that women's football was banned until 51 years ago, and that sounds like a long time, but it's actually not when you think about
crazy to even think about it.
And I think there was a question, I think Rob Pick might have asked it, about goalkeepers. The difference in quality between an outfield player and a goalkeeper, and whether criticisms are fair of goalkeepers. And I think there's no denying that the outfield playing quality compared to the goalkeeping quality, there is a difference. And there's a simple reason for that, in that goalkeeper coaches didn't exist in women's football until around 2015, 2014. So you've got Mary Earps, who's the England number one now. She's a similar sort of age to me. I think she's the same school year as me. She will have gone through her whole childhood going to football sessions, taking part in the football sessions as an outfield player, because you wouldn't have had a goalkeeper coach. And then it would have been go and stand in goal and people will take shots against you, or, go and goal for the game. And she probably didn't have a goalkeeping coach until her early 20s. So all of that development, you just sort of, if you think how much of an impact that has, the tactics, positioning, everything, it's not surprising that the quality of goalkeeping is different to the outfield players.
But you think there's progress in that position then, therefore, because the coaching is there now?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think if you watched a women's football game now from like 2015 to what we will see at the Euros, and you just solely looked at the goalkeeper, 100% there are improvements. And then there's also the issue of height, which you can't get away from. A woman is never going to be as tall as a man. I think Mary Earps, using her as an example, is 5'6", which... people think Jordan Pickford's short. I'm pretty sure Jordan Pickford's 6'1".
Yeah, but he feels short, because most keepers are around the kind of 6'4" height. Yeah.
Yeah, and she's 5'6". So that is, you know, that is a fact. And I think that there is a bit more of a talent ID process now. You know, the game's come on so much that they will start to look for the taller women, you know, like you would with basketball, the taller women to become goalkeepers. But there was never that, that just didn't exist. So, you know, there is always going to be a height issue. But one thing I personally think is, like, watching a women's football match is, it can be unpredictable. But also, we watch football to see goals. And if someone takes a shot which is going in the top corner and the goalkeeper hasn't quite got a long enough arm to save it, then, you know, we want to see goals, don't we?
So it's, you wouldn't advocate the idea if someone suggested you make the goals of the foot smaller or anything like that. You wouldn't be pro that.
No. I mean, it's not practical, I don't think, in terms of, you know, wider provision.
Fine, yeah, no, you might be able
to get the goals in the men's ground, but, you know, you can't, if you had Sunday grassroots football or whatever, you know, it just wouldn't work. But
yeah.
I think another thing is that you're not going to, a goalkeeper in the men's game is jumping, using the power in their legs to jump and make a save from a shot from Kevin De Bruyne. Think about the power maybe that Kevin De Bruyne is going to get in a shot. It's all relative. So Georgia Stanway taking a shot from outside the area is not going to get as much power behind the ball as, say, Kevin De Bruyne does. So the reaction time, the speed, the power needed by the goalkeepers to make that save, it is all relative. Which I think maybe is sometimes misunderstood, because, you know, it's biological fact that men are stronger, quicker.
I don't know. That's just, have we met?
some maybe. but it's, you know, it's vice versa. The strikers, the midfielders, whoever's taking the shot, it's going to be relative power in terms of the goalkeeper making the save. So.
Is it, it's been a positive on it then. Is this something you prefer about women's football versus men's football? Is this something when you watch the two games, it's noticeable to you? You think, I enjoy this aspect of it more of women's football than the men's game?
Yeah, there's always like an element of carnage in the women's football. Like the, I don't know if you saw the.
I feel
the
like
Netherlands
it's calm,
game.
Maybe because I've only watched England's women's really. I feel like they're calm actually.
They're calm on the ball. They're calm on the ball. But I think the, for whatever reason, the quality of attacking is in, when you watch the Euros, and if we speak about England, Spain, Germany, their attacks are all really strong. And you will see some great build-up play and you'll see some good goals. But if you look at it from a defensive point of view, the defensive shapes and structures and the quality of the defences of the best teams are not equal to the attacks, which does sometimes lead to an element of carnage. And that is, you know, that I always cringe when I see them, but you do see videos of women's football on Twitter of, you know, someone's made a mistake and it's led to whatever. But that, I think that does make it enjoyable, because you're always going to get goals. And like I said, the build-up play and the quality of the attacking is still good. You're still able to enjoy that element. But because the defensive side of it is a bit unpredictable, it does kind of,
Does women's football, do you think it still has its innocence? It's something I've said on a few podcasts recently about, I think football has lost its innocence over the last few years. Do you think women's football still has that? Or do we have people diving in the same way in the women's game?
No, you don't. I don't know if that's growing a bit more, but it, like my grandma, for example, she's started watching some of the Super League games. She doesn't have Sky or anything, but, you know, she's got BBC and she'll say, oh, I watch the girls. She's an Arsenal fan, so she said, I watch the girls. And she said, oh, well, you know, they don't roll around like those boys do. and there is a bit more of that, you know, you wouldn't see a women's footballer rolling around like maybe Richarlison does. And I think if you did, it wouldn't be tolerated in women's football. I think, you know, the players would
No, that's fair. I feel like we played Cameroon, I want to say. Forgive me if I've got the wrong team. We played Cameroon in, I want to say, the last 16 of the World Cup. And they lost their minds, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. They fully lost their heads, yeah.
And but I remember it being like, oh, I've never seen this sort of stuff go on the women's game. There was a decision that went to VAR, and they clearly showed the replay in the ground. And this girl was still losing her mind, saying, look at the replay. But that's, do you understand? They'd lost their minds. So that competitive edge is obviously there, a will to win by means.
That game was crazy. I was just thinking back to it. but that sort of thing doesn't really happen. You do get like scuffles and, you know, words exchanged and stuff happen. That's normal. But the sort of faking injury and that sort of gamesmanship side doesn't really exist, and I think that is, you know, there is still that innocence.
Do you think it's to come though, as the game grows?
Possibly. I'd like to think not, but yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, we spoke about role models and, you know, girls having watched men growing up, but they don't seem to have caught that side of it yet, do they?
So if it's the final of the Euros, right, hypothetically, we're playing Spain, it's last minute, Lauren Hemp dives, penalty, wins it, we win. How do we feel?
Oh, we don't care. We've won, don't we?
That's like the bottom line, right?
It's like when Sterling dives in the Euros last year. That was
contact, though, right?
Exactly.
Just don't tell.
If that was another country, you're fuming. It's always different when it's your own team, isn't it?
Couple of questions from the guys on Slack while we're on it. Jarvo says, how far do you see women's football going in the next decade? I can only see continued growth, popularity and involvement. Are there any barriers?
If you're talking decade, a decade ago was sort of the conclusion of the first Women's Super League season. And if you think about how far women's football's come since then, like you spoke about, 2015 being the first major national tournament that maybe you got invested in.
Yeah.
But even then, you know, you probably didn't watch every game. Maybe that grew in that decade. I think this time in 10 years, I would like to think that there'll be maybe tens of thousands of people going to watch women's football games at the highest level on a consistent basis, if the FA can sort of get that target audience right. I'd like to see more sort of, they're called centre of excellences academies, more sort of satellite academies. There's a big issue at the moment with accessibility still in women's football at grassroots level, in that if you don't live in a city or you come from a background where, you know, maybe your parents are working shifts or they can't afford to drive you here, there and everywhere, you don't necessarily have that opportunity. And that's kind of, there was quite a lot of talk about, there was a game recently, the whole starting 11 for England were white, which isn't representative of Britain or England as a country.
I want to say it's all but three or four of the 23 squad, I think.
Yeah.
Doesn't feel right.
No, when you look at the men's team in comparison, you know, that's, and you think about football is a working class sport, and the demographic, particularly in urban and city areas of people within the working class, it's not representative. But I mean, when I was playing for Gillingham, my mum and dad had to drive an hour to take me to that session, and I was fortunate that they gave up two nights a week to do that.
Yeah.
And they were in a position where they could do that, but there's so many families and young people who won't be in a position to do that, so there's still an issue of opportunity, and that only comes from having more academies, more more investment and more local clubs. I think barriers are that at the moment there has been a lot of investment, particularly in the Super League. Barclays and big companies are putting in lots of money.
They've just doubled their sponsorship number, Barclays, I think, haven't they? Yeah.
Yeah, and I know that they've spoken about the fact that they're happy to do that because they see women's football as a growing brand and you know, it can only get bigger. But all of the Super League teams are running at a loss at the moment. So they've got to find a way to make revenue. You know, that could be a barrier. What if they don't start making money and these investors say, well, actually, you know, we've lost this much money and it's not growing.
So the irony is in Circle is it really does need that TV injection, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Is the irony, because it's going to be the biggest income, isn't it?
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, they're only charging, what, £10-15 to go and watch the game. And that's not going to make up. Like you said, that's not going to make up.
Well, no, if these finances are all paid professionals now as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's quite right to understand at the moment that unless you start getting an increased footfall, the clubs will continue to run at a loss. Now, if Manchester United, a women's team, is running at a £500,000 loss, my view would it will just underwrite that. It's not a problem. What you'll do for your brand in the greater, but I don't know, like, does FFP exist in women's football at the moment? I wouldn't know, in all honesty.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't, but it's more of an issue for the smaller clubs. So Birmingham City, for example, there are big issues around them, you know, because the men's team don't have the money themselves. So the Chelseas, the Cities are fine. Aston Villa even are fine because they know that they can get that backing. But yeah, the smaller men's clubs, the women's teams of smaller men's clubs are going to struggle if they don't start.
Yeah. Essentially, any club that comes into hard time is going to have a real problem, as per what you said with Birmingham. I want to say, well, one of the teams going back to kind of the 90s and stuff who were around longer. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, I mean, Doncaster Bells were very big, which is completely random. In more recent times, Nottingham County. And then their women's team, they were a Super League team. Their women's team went because the men's team had financial difficulty.
Yeah.
At a lower level, Gillingham Men did have a women's team who played in the National League, which is League One level of men's football. And because of the pandemic, they couldn't afford it. So now there is no such thing as a Gillingham women's team because they just cut it. The first thing to go that... And I understand that finances, you know, what we've seen with Wigan and Bury and other clubs, you know, it's completely understandable, which is why we need to get women's football into a place where it is making its own money.
Well, to go on a positive then, as Chris Tellis has mentioned, I'm sure you will have seen these figures as well. These attendance numbers at the tournament coming up are amazing to see. Over 500,000 tickets sold, which includes the final is sold out. Unless there's tickets being held back for fans of the supporting clubs, I'm not aware if that's the case or not. The final is a sellout, 90,000 at Wembley. England's opening game at Old Trafford is a sellout on Wednesday night as well. Every England game is sold out. So if you think you're going, you haven't got a ticket, tough shit, unfortunately. The only one you've got a small chance of, if you want to gamble on Bramall Lane or Milton Keynes for the semi-finals, I think there's a handful left.
I think that might have sold out. I'd look earlier.
Is it gone now, is it?
Yeah, the only game outside of the group stages is the winner of Group D playing the runner-up of Group C quarterfinal at Rotherham.
Just to give some perspective on this as well, we're not talking, especially for England, I know there are games at like Man City's Academy and I think it's Lee Rugby where I think Manchester United played some smaller grounds and stuff. But if we think back to England's opening game in 2005, I want to say there was about 25,000 that the Etihad. We're saying,
yeah, and that was record breaking then. That's right.
And we look at it now, we say, actually, there's going to be 70,000 plus at Old Trafford on Wednesday. Say the final was sold out now. We don't know England's going to be in it. The final is sold out. England's other group games are, I think it's the Amex and St Mary's, isn't it?
Southampton, yeah.
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 So, I mean, we're talking 30,000 plus seat stadiums here.
Yeah, big grounds.
Different areas of the country as well. I think, where do England play in the quarters if they go through? I know it's Brentford if they finish runners up. But it's a bigger stadium if they win the quarter final, I think. I'm going to check that for you. It's I think it's Brighton again, actually.
Yeah, it's Southampton or Brighton. I think it's Brighton, the South Coast. Yeah. I didn't get any group game tickets for England, which I'm gutted about. I've got a ticket to the final.
Nice. How much are you selling it for?
Well, you say that. So I've got a ticket to the final, but my other half's basically only got a 2-week annual leave window between now and January. And so we had these 2 weeks. So we booked the flights in March. And it got to like last month, I think when the Premier League was ending, I was like, oh, well, let's look at the Euros fixtures and realised that we fly to our holiday the Sunday morning of the final.
No. So,
yeah, I'm gutted.
This is a heartbreaker. So have you still got the tickets?
I've got the tickets and my friend's taking them. You know, it was actually, there's about 3 people who want them.
I was going to raffle for the patrons there, Lauren. Yeah. Right there, done.
Well, there's 4 of them. I had 4 tickets. And they were 15 quid, which is mental.
The pricing they've got is right as well. And that's helped. Mm. If you're pricing the games at 50, 60 quid, and no, you're not. It's certainly in advance. You're not going to fill out. But the pricing has been sensible. I mean, top tier ticket for England's group game, I want to say it's £30, I think.
£30,
top
end
ticket. And it's £10 beyond the goals, I think. I'm sure is what I've seen. So Clayton has said...
Which is also...
Go on.
So I was going to say, that's also right, because we want to attract families. You want to attract parents and children. And if parents are having to pay for 2 kids and 2 adults, you know, particularly in the current climate, you can't be charging ridiculous amounts.
No, I mean, I've spoken about it. It's off topic, but like concession pricing at Tottenham, like, makes me so vexed sometimes. Anyway, Clayton has obviously asked, and you part answered it, are you going to any games? Are there any others you got in?
I haven't got any tickets yet, but I'm trying to persuade my other half for us to go to the Spain-Germany game next Tuesday.
Nice.
That's at Brentford. And Spain-Germany is one of the games I'm quite, you know, excited to watch generally, so if we can get there.
I was going to say, it's probably the headline game in the group stage, isn't it?
Yeah, because the winner of that game, you know, isn't necessarily going to win the tournament, but Spain are obviously favourites. And the winner of that game, whoever tops that group, is probably going to avoid England. Norway aren't it easy if it is Norway, but it would be a big statement. Whoever wins out of that game is going to be a big statement.
So, spoiler, in case you didn't know, yeah, the losers probably get in England in the quarterfinal. It's not easy, is it?
No.
That could end there and there. The chances are we're playing Germany or Spain in the quarterfinal, basically. I think it's probably fair to say that against Germany, we would be slight favourites at the moment. I believe Spain have now got favouritism in the markets to win the tournament. They've got a large group of the Barcelona contingent that obviously played in the Champions League final, haven't they?
Yeah, and I think that's why they're favourites. But they haven't in recent years...
I've never known them to be involved, I don't think. They've occasionally had 1 or 2 individuals, but I've never known them to be considered as one of the top in terms of favouritism.
No, I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure they haven't made it past the quarterfinals of a major tournament, since, you know, early 90s, which is staggering considering the fact that Barcelona won the Champions League and, you know, just how good they have been. And I think because of the sort of surgence of Barcelona in the women's game and the fact that the Spanish team, their whole spine is pretty much Barcelona. I think that's probably why the bookies have got them as favourites, but it's really wide open. There's sort of 6 teams, in my opinion, that if any one of them won it, I wouldn't be surprised. That's pre-tournament, you know, anything could happen.
Who do you think will win it?
Well, my heart would like to say England.
There's a bug coming, Lauren. You're about to let everybody down.
the fact that it's a home tournament and the fact that we've got a manager who has
on it,
been there, done it, and knows the women's game, she's taken risks. She dropped Steph Houghton, which was a huge call.
I couldn't believe that when I saw that, by the way. But I'm right in saying, has she not played at all since January? She had quite a serious Achilles injury, right?
Yeah, she had a very serious injury. She was just coming back. And to be honest, I think it was the right call. You know, she wasn't going to be captain anyway. She hasn't got match fitness. Yes, she's got experience, but there are other players in that squad who have got experience. Jill Scott, Lucy
Bronze. Massive call, though. She's played in so many tournaments, hasn't she?
Yeah. Yeah, she has. But I think there seems to be a bit more of a focus on the future. It's a very young squad, and we have got some really good young talent. And yeah, she's not afraid to make big decisions. So I'd like to say England, but I'm going to say Sweden. I think
okay,
Sweden were runners up in the Olympics. They've sort of gradually been growing. They've got a well-rounded team. They've got Magda Eriksson who plays for Chelsea. They're not the glamour choice, and for some reason they're fifth in the bookies.
I'm looking at it right now. You are correct in terms of best price you can get. Yes.
Yeah, I think they're level. The Netherlands are ahead of them, which seems crazy because the Netherlands are not in a great place.
Well, and they're in the same group as well. And obviously, we dismantled them the other week in the second half at Elland Road. So you think Sweden will top that group C? We would presume those two teams will go through.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if they didn't. The Netherlands just don't seem in a good place. And I mean, their manager came out and said, "Oh, we're 2 weeks behind England in our preparation." But at that point, it was 2 weeks to the tournament. So, you know, what? Why are you so far behind? What are you doing? The Netherlands do have Vivian Miedema, though, who is, you know, she can score from anywhere. So she's.
You've just pleased Adam Pritchard, our Arsenal correspondent. About once a week, he tweets about her. Bless him.
She's very good. She's very good.
Yeah, no, I defend it. She is.
But yeah, so I think Sweden. But as I said, I wouldn't be surprised. And this sort of comes back to women's football being unpredictable. Any of those six teams, you wouldn't be surprised. Well, I probably would be surprised if France win it because they.
Well, I was going to say I've heard that the French camp. It's a bit mad what's going on. The manager should have been sacked, but hasn't. Apparently, she's left a few big names out as well. What's going on now?
Henri and Le Sommer, who are big names, the highest scoring French women's footballer ever. Henri got the Champions League player of the match in the final. Yeah, these are the big names. It's like dropping, I don't know, I was going to say Kane and Sterling, maybe not Sterling, Kane and Foden, Grealish, you know.
You were going to say Maguire, weren't you?
Maybe Maguire. No, that's Steph Houghton. But yeah, it's and there's no. I mean, Henri, I understand, fell out with the manager after the 2017 tournament. So you can understand that maybe there's a rift between manager and player, but there hasn't really been an announcement about Le Sommer and why she's not in the squad. So that seems strange. And then you've got this whole assault situation where
was this Diallo, the girl with PSG the player. Was it at Lyon or was it PSG? Sorry, where she got a teammate beat up.
That was the story, and it hasn't. She hasn't really been seen since. She didn't.
Staggering.
She wasn't called.
Well, you told us women's football still had its innocence.
Well, yeah, but French football was mental in general, wasn't it?
Well, no, that's true.
You got like Benzema and the men's team, and all the fans fighting all the you know in the league and matches. French football's just seems to carnage seems to follow French football for some reason.
If we've got any French patrons, do let us know. I've got a feeling we haven't.
Yeah, sorry, I don't mean to offend.
You never hear of French players playing FPL. Come to think of it, do let us know if we've got any French patrons. I'd love to know. Can I make a critical comment? And it's just looking at the groups. I always say about the Champions League every year, as much as we all say, oh, there's nothing wrong with the Champions League, we want to keep it as it is. Most of us can kind of sit there from eight groups and go 12 or 13 teams, we know they're going through. It's normally the case. Mm-hmm. Are we looking at these groups here in the Euros? Can we pick the six definites, basically, and arguably seven and eight, to know what the final eight will be?
I think it would be a surprise if those six don't go through. However, having said that, if one of them isn't going to go through, I think it is France or Netherlands. You've got teams like Italy, who are maybe overlooked. They've got some good players. They've got one of their strikers plays for Juventus, and Juventus did actually beat Lyon in a Champions League game this season, which was a big shock because Lyon are such a big team in the women's game. So I think Italy could cause shocks. I think Iceland, a bit like, was it 2016 World Cup when we got knocked out?
Don't remind us. 16 Euros. Yeah. It was in Nice, which I want to say is where the girls played quite a bit a couple of years ago. It was also in Nice, I'm fairly certain.
Yeah. They've got a chance of causing a shock. I can't say the player's name, but they've got a player who plays in the Super League. I'm not going to embarrass myself by trying to say a name, who is very good. Then you've got teams like Denmark, who Pernille Harder plays for Chelsea. Very good forward player. So I think there are a core six teams who, yes, they've had massive investment. They've been they've got maybe the top leagues within the women's game. And like we were talking about outfield players and goalkeepers, the national teams who have had investment and have been supported for over years are a step above the rest. Yeah. You saw that when England won 20-0.
It was Latvia, wasn't it?
Latvia, yeah. And there were loads of comments from people who maybe don't understand women's football about, well, that's ridiculous. How can that happen? But you see it when England beat San Marino 10-0, and it's obviously not as big a scoreline, but it's a similar situation in that the Latvian population might be bigger than San Marino, but the investment in the women's team is...
I was going to say, I mean, I'm always very critical of England playing nations like San Marino in the men's game, but then they've had, 30 years now, I guess, of trying to develop their football. I guess women's football in Latvia, for example, just to use that as an example, because we've played them, is obviously at its infancy, isn't it? And it's going to take a long time and needs that investment. Which not all of these countries are going to give. I saw there were a number of countries. I mean, Bulgaria was one. They didn't even try and participate in qualifying, to give you an example. And I think they're ranked about 50 or 60th in the women's game, but they didn't put a team out to try and qualify, I was reading. It sounds like Denmark have had the worst of the draw then, if they're a decent side, and they've got Germany and Spain.
And that's why they're maybe not being tipped up to do well, because Germany and Spain are so good. But they do have a good chance, Denmark. I think, maybe like that, the men's team last year at the Euros, they could be the surprise package. If they can get a result against Germany or Spain, then, who knows what could happen. Spain have lost their star striker, Hermoso. And in the friendlies building up to the Euros, they've struggled a bit to be clinical. So Spain are going to dominate the ball and they're going to create chances, but I think whether they can put the chances away could be the difference.
And our group, it's perhaps not as easy as it looks on paper. Norway, Austria, Northern Ireland. I think in terms of favouritism in the group, that's probably how we'd expect it to finish. England, Norway, Austria, Northern Ireland. I know we beat Austria 1-0 in, because we've actually got Austria and Northern Ireland in World Cup qualifying at the moment as well. And we are already qualified. We beat Austria 1-0 at home. We yet to play them away. Northern Ireland, I think we'd beat 4-0 at home, but it was 0-0 for a long time, wasn't it? That game was played at Wembley. It was 0-0 to about 25 minutes to go, I think. And we beat them 5-0 away. And Norway will be a challenge. But does it matter if we come first or second per se? We're going to get Germany or Spain anyway, by the sounds of it. So,
yeah, it probably doesn't. But I think you always want to go into quarterfinals having played well and, you know, not have a negative about, you know, how the group. And I know once you get to the knockout stages, you know, anything can happen, but you don't want to get to those knockout stages having lost to Norway and, you know, maybe drawn to Austria or Northern Ireland. That's just not going to be a good good sort of stepping stone into the quarterfinals.
Certainly in the men's Euros, and I know it's 2014 tournament, but it really feels like it doesn't kick. As long as you get through, and then it kicks off, obviously, from the last 16 stage and in that tournament. Is this a bit like that as well, do you think? Or would that be a real serious blow if we got beat by Norway?
I don't think it'd be a blow because they're not, you know, they're no mugs. It's not an embarrassment to lose to Norway. The concern going into the Euros for England is that in the build-up friendlies, they have struggled to score in the first half of games and they've relied on the substitutes. Now, that's not necessarily an issue in that we have a very strong squad. We've got lots of young attacking talent. But I think in the warm-up games, the defence looked a bit shaky. And that could have, you know, when you're coming up against the top sides, if they've scored, if, you know, if not playing well in the first half and they've taken the lead early on 1-2-0, you're then on the back foot. And obviously it's very different coming back from a loss than going in at half-time 0-0. So that would be a concern. There's also a bit of a confusion and a maybe not a full understanding of Leah Williamson's role in the team. So she...
I'm hearing she might play centre-back, right?
I think she'll start at centre-back. But she is a centre-back and she was playing in centre midfield with Kira Walsh because she'd been injured and Greenwood and Bright had striked up quite a strong centre-back partnership. But then Williamson playing with Walsh wasn't really working. So Williamson did drop back in against Switzerland, which I think is the right call because I think she is the strongest centre-back we've got. Millie Bright and Alex Greenwood both have the tendency to mess things up every now and again. But then there's a question mark about Greenwood, whether she goes left back, because that's where she used to play, but she hasn't played there for her club for ages. So there's just, you know, there's quite a few question marks over. And I guess it was the same last year with Gareth Southgate. We didn't know what he was going to do, but we don't know what the best starting 11 is.
But then there's depth to this squad. That's what I do keep hearing. There are game changers who can change the game for this England team if they don't start.
Yeah, and you could... I don't know what front three she will choose, but any front three she chooses, I don't think you could argue. So you've got Lauren Hemp, Chloe Kelly, Ellen White, Russo impressed in the friendlies recently, but that Ellen White had COVID. So I don't know which way she's going to go. You've got Beth Mead. Georgia Stanway's obviously a midfielder, but it's very good going forward. You've got Rachel Daly, who can also, you know, do well on the front foot. Someone else who just gone out of my brain. Oh, Beth England. Beth England plays for Chelsea. She's, you know, so there's lots of attacking talent. And that is the good thing. You know, if we are 60 minutes in and we need a goal, we've got the quality. It's just whether we are still in the game at that point.
I hadn't realised that Lucy Bronze had moved on from City. Didn't she leave Lyon to come back to City? I was just looking at a squad list and she's at Barcelona now.
That was announced, I think, last week. That was announced.
Oh, right. Okay. I'm giving myself an excuse for not realising that she hasn't played yet.
So she moved back from Lyon because she was homesick. And I'm pretty sure she made a comment
You're
about...
suggesting she went to Manchester and went, no, I'll go back again.
Well, I'm pretty sure she's made a comment about Manchester not feeling like home.
Oh, well, at least she's not playing at Old Trafford on Wednesday night. Oh. And she's a super player, isn't she?
Yeah. I mean, she's 30 now, so she's, you know, going off coming sort of towards the end of her career, but you know.
I can tell you that a few summers ago, that there was a bit of a running joke going on in the Linden household, that she would probably solve Tottenham's right back issue. such were the problems we were having there with the likes of Serge Aurier and others. Has there been a temptation to use her elsewhere? Because she's always stood out so much, as in positionally, I mean.
I guess a bit like Trent, you know, she could play in midfield. She's got a great ball, you know, just the number of assists she's got, not just in the England team, but for City, from, you know, crosses that she gets from going down the right wing. She does have quite a free rein to get forward, which makes me nervous because I know that Millie Bright is there waiting, and she's not the quickest, but she could easily play midfield. I don't think she's necessarily a forward. You know, she's not. She can strike a ball, but you know, she'd do well in centre mid. But yeah, she's coming towards the sort of back end of her career, and I guess she's gone to Barcelona because it's the biggest club. Obviously, they didn't win the Champions League, but it is the biggest club in women's football at the moment. Everyone thought she was going to America because that's more of it's a stronger league. It's more competitive. The women's league in America has obviously been professional for a lot longer than the English league. But I am surprised she's chosen Barcelona because the Spanish league is weak. Barcelona are obviously amazing. Real Madrid are improving. Atletico Madrid are okay, but everyone else is very average. As you'll see, if you look at the league tables from the Spanish league, Barcelona just smash everyone. Romp it. Yeah, and she's gone for the Champions League. She's, you know, she wasn't going to win the Champions League at City.
Why not, if I can ask? Are the English sides just too far away at the moment?
Yeah, I think that Champions League final between Barcelona and Chelsea sort of highlighted that. I'd say the Women's Super League is the most competitive in that the gap between the top and the bottom is probably closer than most of the other European leagues. But we are attracting better players generally. If you looked at the number of players that play in each of the European leagues that are at the Euros, I'd put money on that the Women's Super League would have the most. But yeah, they're not. Chelsea have been the best team for a few years now, and Emma Hayes is an amazing manager, but they're not at the same level as Barcelona and Lyon. And I don't know if maybe they need to get a couple more really big names, but Lyon were that big name for years. You know, they won 5-6 Champions Leagues and that's where everyone went. And that's kind of how it's been in women's football, is there's a big team. That's how it is, you know, in the Super League. Chelsea, Arsenal, Man United and City. That if you're the best in the league, you're going to go to one of those four clubs. That's just how it is. But yeah, because they're still not quite at that top European level. But I don't like Chelsea, but I do hope Emma Hayes gets to winning a Champions League.
She was a question, and this was really interesting. I actually caused a bit of debate in the house. You ever watched Pointless?
Yes.
So for those who've never seen Pointless, basically you have to guess the most obscure answers. And it was a picture round, and they had famous Emmas. So Emma Hayes comes up to one of the pictures, and I said to the wife, "You know her, who is it?" And she couldn't remember her name. She knew who it was. She said, I know she's a manager of women's football. I don't know her name. Okay, she got one step there. How many she scored, Emma Hayes?
Three.
Zero. Which is interesting when people would... I'm sure if I asked... I reckon if I polled the patrons, I reckon half. could name Emma Hayes now, I would guess.
But that's interesting. She did commentary, didn't she, last year, which probably elevated her name a bit more in men's football fans.
I know she was tweeting today, having a whinge about no women's Panini sticker book as well. She was somewhere, she couldn't find a women's Panini sticker book. She's doing her best for the game as well, bless her.
Yeah, she is. She's a massive advocate.
Could she take the job, do you think, at some point?
I hope she would. I think she'd be great for England. She's very down to earth, though. So she, you know, I think she'll probably feel that she's got a role to do in the Women's Super League to help elevate it to a certain point. And maybe when she thinks she's done what she can, maybe then she'll go to England. I've got one of my mates from uni plays with her best mate. So I hear quite a few anecdotal stories from her about, you know, what she does. And she's very grounded, you know, she's a working class. She's come from a background where, you know, her dad didn't have a lot of money and worked really hard to get her into football. And obviously you wouldn't think that now, but she will have seen such progress in the women's game, and she's so passionate about it that I think she will want to make sure that she's done all she can for the league and young girls in England before moving on to that job. But I mean, even being in that job, she's going to be able to have a huge impact as well, isn't she?
Absolutely. I mean, she's very much, I mean, you mentioned earlier in terms of role models, she's almost become the face of the women's game in this country. I think it's quite remarkable, actually, and part because of what you said, her contribution in terms of putting many men under the table. That's a really bad expression now, but you know what I mean, in terms of her football knowledge. When she was covering the Euros last summer, outstanding. She clearly knows the game inside out. I told you when we started this, Lauren, half hour, maybe 45 minutes. It's been about an hour and 20 minutes or so, I think. It's been an absolutely fascinating chat. I'm exaggerating a bit, about an hour or a quarter or so. A couple of quick questions before we finish up. Who's going to win the tournament for England in one name?
Lauren Hemp.
That's what I thought you were going to say. And are you playing fantasy at all?
Yeah, so there's this She Plays, isn't there? I haven't had a chance.
There's a few going about. It's Starling Bank and someone else as well, I think. But
yeah, I mean,
She Plays seems the one to me.
Yeah, if you're going to set up a Patreon league, I'll do whatever that one is. But
I'll get it done.
Yeah, I did have a look, and I'm a bit annoyed that the UEFA app aren't doing one, which seems like a missed opportunity. And again, this is maybe when we're talking about women's football, the next Euros, maybe that is something that.
To go back to Emma Hayes and the Panini sticker book and stuff, right?
Yeah, and I think that's also a way in, isn't it? Think about how many people watch the Premier League because they play FPL. If you had some kind of free fantasy game, I know for a fact when the Scottish football started and I'd made a Scottish team. You know, I don't normally follow Scottish football, but I knew who was the starting 11 of Livingston, and like.
Really?
You know, silly things like that. But because you're making a team.
Can you do my team in that next year, please?
Well, then the Premier League starts and I don't pay attention anymore. But, you know, that's another way of getting people in, isn't it? And taking an interest.
It's a miss. I think they've got prediction comps up and stuff like that. Yes. But it feels in terms of engagement. I mean, one of the things for me to actually play the Fantasy Scotland, it's very off topic, but was actually to improve my own knowledge of the Scottish Premier League and the players playing in it and stuff. And subconsciously, that just happens. It might be that my assessment is biased because of fantasy football. But yeah, exactly what you said. It felt like an easy win and an easy way in for engagement. I'm pretty confident that it will get addressed because enough people have spoken up about it. Plus, I'm sure they know how popular their Champions League and Euro fantasy games have been globally as well. So hopefully that sign will get amended. Lauren, absolute star. Thank you so much for your time. I've taken way too much of it, mate. Where can everyone follow you?
Oh, well, I've got that Twitter, but I don't, to be honest,
I've got that Twitter, but I fucking hate it.
I don't even know what my handle is, to be honest. I don't know.
I've tagged you a few times recently.
Speak to me on Patreon. That's the best way to access me.
Speak to Lauren on Patreon. I will promise, guys, I will get the She Plays League set up, and I'm going to set up a women's football Slack channel as well, not just for the tournament, but beyond as well, because it regularly comes up in conversation, whether someone's posting in the Arsenal channel about the women's game or something. I'd like to have a centralised place where people can feel free and open to discuss the game at more length. Lauren, thank you so much for your time. Absolute pleasure. That other idiot will be back tomorrow. Tottenham on Patreon, guys. Probably not fireworks at this stage. Sudge is more worried about what Erling Haaland's going to do in game week one, judging by Monday's podcast. And he's also told me in secret that he's not going to be at the first Planet FPL derby this season. I think he's properly shitting it. Let's speak more about that tomorrow. Lauren, thank you so much for your time. Cue music, please, man child.
The Fantasy Football Show.